interpreters for the last month. So I'd be in Poland and I'd, you know, say a sentence and then someone translates. I was wondering, why is it? It's strange now just to talk in a run. You know what I mean? And I'm waiting for the pause, but wait a minute, there's no interpreter here. The mind gets very kind of easily conditioned, just that. So I've just been a month in other countries where most people don't speak English, so I've needed interpreters, and all of a sudden I get used to a certain pattern. And interesting how quick that happens. And then, so now I'm speaking, I haven't been teaching for a while, just been rapping with my mother and so on. And all of a sudden it feels strange. It's interesting how quickly we get, our minds get conditioned to things. Not that it's right or wrong, but if the conditioning becomes very, very deep, then you can see, and then one gets out of that, then what in psychology they say, you get out of your comfort zone, then you can get irritated or angry or frightened or confused or doubtful. All kinds of things can come up around that. And so the teaching around impermanence and uncertainty is this continual reminder that not to take any position, not to take refuge in that which is changing, but find refuge in that which knows change. The difference, isn't there? I take refuge in a kind of, in a permanent interpreter, then I feel uncomfortable. But if I say there's no refuge and things change and I feel uncomfortable with that, oh, this is what discomfort is, I'm aware of discomfort, then that doesn't go into fear or anger or irritation or whatever. Take extreme examples of that are like people who, like when I left England for Thailand, I was asked to go. I'd been in Thailand for four or five years, and I'd been in India a year and a half, so I was very much used to Asia. And being a Buddhist monk in Thailand is great. You know, it's 99% Buddhist country, so people actually know what you are. Then being sent to England, asked to go to England, I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay in Thailand, but teacher says, okay. Then feeling like, one of our monks would say, feeling like a fish in a tree in London. And then the sense of actually being homesick for Thailand. And so there, that, you know, one, I had become comfortable with being a monk in Thailand. Then I put in another culture. I feel homesick and I feel kind of self-conscious and cold, rain, you know, depressed, things like that. And but the practice of mindfulness is noticing that, okay, the external situation has changed. Why can't I change with it? Why do I get depressed? Or why do I get irritated? Why do I get angry? Why can't I flow? What is it about me? Why am I attached to a certain way of being? So that the whole way of the Buddhist practice is very flexible. It's this kind of portability. It's not just a sort of a meditation cushion practice, a zafu practice, or a temple practice, or a churchy practice. It's all the time practice. It's having this adaptability and awareness. And so when there is discomfort or some sense of dislocation, to go right to those feelings and not add to them with thought, just be very patient with them until they settle and the mind becomes calm again. So for me in Thailand, I'm in England, that was a very good lesson. It's a painful lesson, but it's kind of a good lesson in how I'd become attached to being a monk in Thailand. And I didn't know it in Thailand. I could only know it in England. So this refuge is a refuge in awareness, refuge in Buddha, the refuge in Dharma, refuge in Sangha, are things that you cultivate in your own heart. The ability to be awake, to be present, to notice conflict, to let go of conflict, to understand conflict, to know how to put it down. To understand stress, to know how to put it down. It's a kind of inner education that we go through. When I was in Latvia just now, my people are from Latvia, and I met a second cousin who I didn't even know existed through various magical circumstances. I met this person, and so my parents had fled in 1944, and her parents stayed behind. She's 63 now, and very hard time, you know, father sent to Siberia and all that kind of story, But when she started her work career, she went through a phase where she was, the word they use is repressed, and it's a different word than our psychological word repressed. It's when the communist hierarchy began to, for some reason, victimize her and her family. So she was constantly had this kind of psychological torture at work in different situations. She wasn't sent to Siberia, but the whole social atmosphere was very, very, very difficult. And she made a choice. She used to be a runner in high school and university. And she made a choice. She said, well, either I start drinking, and not water, vodka, either I start drinking or I'll start running. She began to run. So she took up jogging, which wasn't a popular form of exercise in where she's from. And she took up jogging to survive. So rather than getting utterly devastated by some very, very difficult situation, she just worked it off through running. And to me, that's a kind of marvelous story of will, where she, through a very difficult circumstance, she used willpower to overcome a situation which I don't know if I could have overcome it. You know, I probably would have hit the bottle or something. I found out that I have three first cousins. I'd completely lost track of them. And all three were alcoholics. And one is still alive and he's an alcoholic. So I kind of wonder, well, if I hadn't got out of that place, would I have hit the bottle too? Anyway, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm glad. I'm glad I'm Canadian. So that kind of use of willpower is obviously very skillful, very kind of inspiring, isn't it, when someone takes a situation which is totally oppressive and gets through it through their own resources, through their own means. In social situations, sometimes we need to be passive and receptive, and sometimes we need to be assertive, don't we? Sometimes we need to listen and just take in what's going on, but sometimes we need to say, no, that's enough, you shouldn't do that, or that's not right, we need to be assertive. So around energy and effort, there's no one way that you operate, is there, either socially or inwardly. Now the meditative life is not one of just trying to control everything, just trying to control your emotions or control your mind or just get rid of the nasty bits of your psyche that you don't like and getting the good guys going. It's not just kind of some kind of control mechanism, because if that's the only thing it is, just control, you eventually just can't do that. You can't just keep controlling. You eventually fall apart. And yet, if there's no effort, if we don't make any kind of effort, then we just are sort of victimized by our own mind states. We just keep victimized by depression or fears or whatever it might be. So the one of the ways to look at effort in Buddhism is, first of all, to understand what we mean by being awake, actually awakening to how things are. Now that's neither passive nor active, it's an alivening or enlightening of the mind. The way I like to do that is by when I begin meditation, I like to listen to sound. And when you listen to sound, without any preference to the type of sound, you're not using willpower to get or get rid of, but you are putting effort to awaken. So there's some will, obviously, to do that, just to say, ah, this is the way it is now, this is the sound here now. But it's not an effort to become or to get rid of, okay? And that's the first step, to understand what it means to be awake, because that's what awareness is. And the Buddhist path is based upon awareness. So if we don't understand what awareness is, and we are just coming from some ideal that I shouldn't be angry, or I shouldn't be fearful, or I should do this, I shouldn't do that, we're just coming from some ideal, then there's always a kind of conflict in our lives. And we don't understand actually the basis of the conflict, because we've misinterpreted the teaching. So awareness does not imply that you're feeling nice, or that you love everyone, or that you love the Buddha, or that you even have faith in Buddhism. Awareness is not saying anything about the quality of one's experience, but rather it's awakening to the quality of the experience. So it has a kind of neutral It's not about quality, it's about awakening to quality. It's not about a certain kind of experience, it's about knowing this experience feels this way. Right? And if you don't get that right, I don't think you can get anything right in Buddhism. You can live a good life and not, you know, kill the neighbors if they're too loud or something like that. But basically, the real meditative, spiritual part of the practice requires this very simple understanding of what awareness is. Idealism is not awareness. Being aware of ideals and being aware of judgments and guilts and so on is different than the attachment to ideals. So that's the first step in effort, awakening. And if we learn to do that a lot, then what opens up in consciousness is a kind of objectivity and spaciousness. Objectivity, like in the sense that you begin to see the movement of consciousness more objectively rather than being caught up. In Thai tradition, they say madness is damaged awareness. They say if someone is having some kind of psychotic episode, they would say see a sati, which means damaged awareness. Which is, if you think about it, someone who is caught up in some very difficult psychosis, they have no awareness, they have no space, they have no objectivity, they're completely caught in some awful drama, and they totally believe in it. And that's the nature of madness, isn't it? So we're all a bit mad. You know, we all get caught, we lose the spaciousness, we lose the objectivity around certain inner mind states. And it's coming back to that objectivity, to that, what is awareness, the returning to that is the kind of beginning of the practice. Now if you have that, and you're really awake, then you can kind of make efforts and try things out. Not from any kind of a judgment or an aversion or a trying to get rid of or repression or denial, not from those kinds of spaces, but from just open awareness. So then you can try something, you can try a lot of effort, or you can just try to be really patient with something. And then you can learn, because the ground of your practice, the ground of your experiment, the basis of your experiment is the open mind. You can notice things. But if you're just coming at it from an idea, I should get rid of this, then there's already conflict. There's no real understanding. So say something like you find you have a lot of aversion or something. If the ideal that I shouldn't be averse, that I should have compassion, doesn't really awaken you, it just makes you feel guilty. But awakening to the feeling of aversion and wanting to go beyond it, obviously, because no one wants to live in a life of aversion, because it's a hell realm. But awakening, aversion feels this way, investigating in the body, observing the thoughts, learning to let go of the thoughts, all that is more like an inner education, an inner edification, which takes place through awareness practice. So then you can make effort. You can really try to kind of get rid of the thoughts by focusing on breath. Or you can think more thoughts. Or you can feel the emotions in your heart and do all kinds of things. And much of meditative life is that kind of creative experimentation around your own karma, around your own habits, and then learning from that. But the basis is awareness. So what we do in a day of mindfulness is basically cultivate awareness. Cultivate mindfulness, which is being present, being present, being present. Nothing very special, but extraordinarily powerful, actually. It's not like you're learning to levitate. You know, you think you get these great powers in meditation, but the ordinariness of meditation sometimes is... people don't understand how powerful that really is. But if I can spend a whole day where I just remember the present moment, keep coming back to the present moment. It's very boring. Your mind goes off into the future, the past. You know, you have to be quite diligent, and there's effort in that. But then you create this kind of space in which, when the mind begins to get caught up with its attachments, you have the space and objectivity to notice that. You create the ground, the framework, the basis for edification, for understanding, for insight. So do contemplate what we mean by awareness, or what you mean by awareness. We kind of throw this word around a lot. What is awareness to you? Awareness is, to me, the awakening to the way things are. And then I can, like, say with thought, I can see, like, the whole sense of I is just thought. If you really observe what the sense of me as a separate individual, it's always through thought, future, past. And once you get to know that, and you get to see that actually the types of thoughts are conditioned by the moods. The types of thoughts are symptomatic of moods. So if I feel depressed, I have depressive I thoughts. If I feel excited, I have exciting I thoughts. So this is quite simple, really. And once you see that, and then your mind moves into thought, no. You come back to the body. Because you don't want to get reborn as a depressive person, or as a frightened person, or as a whinging person, or as a whatever person. You don't want to get reborn into that realm. You don't want to be recreating that in your mind. And so you move back to the present moment, to the breath, to kindness, but not from control or repression or idealism, but from mindfulness. It's a kind of clear, and that's willpower, that's using will, but it's not the willfulness of it's not violent. I mean, we can do violence to ourselves in the spiritual life by being very judgmental and harsh. But it is an effort, isn't it? It's not just kind of hanging out with depression for 6 years, you know, or fear, but actually doing something about it, noticing the thoughts, moving away from the thoughts. So may I suggest now for this day, I just kind of suggest little techniques. Whatever works for you is fine. But do really, like, use this time to, one, be in the present moment. Learn to be with what you're feeling, with your body. And if you have strong emotions, fine, feel them. But try to feel them as a present moment physical experience rather than a whole storyline of the past coming into the present moment. Try to feel it as a present moment experience. And really try to move away from the self thoughts, the I thoughts, the personality view, the psychological self, all these little stories that go on all the time. Just try to come back to simple things like the sound of a fan, the feeling of your feet, these little things. And so the whole of the mind is going to continue composed, centered, centered, centered. That's training. That's just the training that we do. It's quite lovely, simple. It's not sort of, you know, kind of trying to become Tiger Woods or anything, you know, it's not so spectacular. But it has its effect. It's quite effective. So let's do some more sitting practice. Stretch your legs a bit if you want, and then take a posture. She's grounded and craving is going to work. So one of the ways you define nirvana is when the heart is free from craving, free from need. Free from need for sensual distraction, free from the need to become, free from the need to repress. So earlier I was saying one has to get the fundamental attitudes right. And I was also talking about effort. So how do you make effort without desire? Well, there is desire, isn't there? There's a kind of aspiration in our mind where we want to be. You know, we want a heart of love rather than a heart of hatred. We want a mind which is silent rather than maybe a mind which is endlessly whinging on or whatever it might be doing. So obviously there's an aspiration we have in our hearts. So that's a kind of good desire, isn't it? But if the energy is an energy of sort of ego becoming, I'm going to become something in the future, and craving is always conjoined with ignorance, and it's the ignorance of what you might call a psychological self, the whole sense of me becoming something, then that me becoming something, it's going to be the wrong way of doing it. But if you understand how the mind works, if you understand how effort works, then by making the right application of mind, doing the right practices, you should get the right result. So it's not like me getting rid of this moment to become something else, but it's just doing the right things, doing the right practices, there's the right attitudes, continually doing that creates the right environment and the right result. So it's not a becoming, it's always a very present effort. So say something like, if I have a habit of complaining, say, in my mind just tends to, through bad conditioning, kind of be negative all the time, complaining about this, complaining about my society, about my family, about myself, about the weather, about the color of whatever, you know, the kind of complaining mind. And I noticed that, well, I don't really want to live my life as a whinger. It's not a very happy way to live my life. And so I make some kind of, I have some kind of desire not to be a whinger, complaining all the time. Someone says to me, God, you're a dumb, you're always whinging. I said, no, I'm not. You're complaining. And then, but I realize, okay, I want to get beyond that whinging, complaining mind. So that's, you could say that's desire. It's an aspiration. But then you have to understand how the mind works to go beyond that. So if I say, I want to go beyond just complaining and being negative all the time, and then each time that comes up, I just try to get rid of that, stop complaining, that won't work. That's repression. It might be good intention, but it'll still be violent. But there's this kind of violence. I shouldn't complain. Shut up. I'm really being happy now. I'm not going to be negative. And then and that's the kind of imposition of control that we put on consciousness. And yet, if we don't make some kind of effort, our minds can just fall into these negative habits of thought. So, like, understanding how a habit arises and how it keeps going, how it's fed. What feeds, say, the habit of complaining? Well, obviously what feeds it is thought. Right? So seeing first of all how a negative habit works, understanding it is a big part of the way of liberation. So we say the Buddhist path is a way of wisdom, it's the way of insight. So one has to see first of all, okay, there is a habit, I want to go beyond that. Well, how does this habit manifest? How does it keep going in my mind? And then I notice memory, and then or a sense. Like maybe the music next door. And if you like country and western, you're doing fine, I'm sure. But let's say I'm sitting here, and my mind starts to hear the music. That's a sense impression. And then the first reaction is, why don't they shut up? You know, this is a temple. Why don't they just turn that damn thing off? And the mind starts to complain. So there's sense contact, right? Sense impression, and then there's the reaction to sense impression, the complaining, maybe. For instance. So acceptance practice is like, okay, this is the way it is now, and what kind of habits is my mind engaged in right now? What kind of thoughts are there? What kind of reactions are there to the way things are now? And if I'm listening, this kind of inner listening, inner awareness, noticing, I notice that the sound is as it is. But I want it to be other than it is, and my mind starts to complain. And I begin to see, well, that complaining part is something I'm creating, something I'm doing for the moment. I notice that whole structure. And then I begin to not think that way. But not from repression. You know, it's not like, stop thinking, you're dumb. It's not violent. It's, no, I'm not going to go that way. So I accept the fact that the mind is conditioned towards complaining, but I'm not going to complain. You see what I mean? Which is different than just saying, stop. You know, we get into this inner argument. And the mind starts to complain. I shouldn't be complaining. Now stop complaining, Viradhammo. And it starts to complaining. And it's not like an inner argument. It's a very skillful movement away from something which is unskillful. So I notice the mind start to think unskillful things. They go back to the breath. Or I say, may they enjoy themselves. Or whatever I do. But the movement is not one of violence, or becoming, or getting rid of. It's skillful. It's from acceptance. It's into whatever object you want to look at. So that movement away from the habit towards something skillful is something you have to train yourself to do, because the habit can be very strong. If I've caught in the habit of negativity for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, I begin to notice. I begin to work on it. It's going to take a while. The habit, the force of habit, and the force of habit is what we mean by karma, that's still going to come welling up into consciousness. So even though I have the yearning to be free from a negative habit, it's still going to come up, because that's the way the mind has been conditioned. But at least if I understand that movement of thought towards negativity, I can say no, I can come back to the breath. And that I might have to do 100 times in 10 minutes. Who knows? It depends on the strength of the habit. But if I keep doing that, and I do it quite skillfully with acceptance, then the habit begins to die, because I'm not conditioning the mind by just being lost in that habit, but I'm also not repressing it. You know, I'm not denying its existence. I'm not being violent to myself. So there's like a skillful movement from acceptance. There is effort. There is right effort. But the effort's not based on craving, on ego craving. It's on wisdom, based on wisdom. So to do this, you need to be aware. You need to be awake. You need to be listening to your inner world. Not obsessed with it, but just know your inner world. One needs to know how the moods of the mind condition certain kinds of thoughts. One has to see how certain kinds of thoughts and moods are very unskillful. And if we pursue them, we get unskillful results. And then one needs to have means and methods to shift attention to that which is skillful. We use body a lot. We use the recollection of kindness a lot. But if the underlying principles aren't understood, if it's just done as a kind of thou shalt be a good Buddhist, you know, from that kind of being good obligation kind of practice, it won't work because it's not wisdom. But wisdom is really like really understanding yourself very clearly how these things work. It takes a lot of patience. You have to be very, very patient. But you also have to be very determined. You have to be quite determined to transform consciousness. It just doesn't happen by itself. So there is effort. I began this morning by speaking of will, the use of will. You know, I was saying, like, sometimes in a social situation you have to be assertive, and sometimes you have to be receptive, passive. It's the same with your own mind. Sometimes you just don't understand what's going on. You just have to watch it for a while. You know, you just kind of observe, you're confused or whatever, and then you begin to see patterns. And then you learn how to shift attention away from the unskillful. Or sometimes you need to go into something. So if you have some kind of unresolved grief, say, that grief comes welling up during a retreat, and then you don't have to move away from it. You have to maybe move into it in a bodily way, feel the grief, allow the grief to go through you. And these are very individual patterns that we all work through. But understanding thought is terribly important, really, and seeing how the sense of I is created through thought. That's the mischievous part of the mind. There is right thought, you know, there is right thought, but that habitual I thought, psychological self thought, has to be seen as just that, just a formation of mind. Any questions around that or anything else before we sit again? Chief?
Would you call it uncertainty? I have a thought pattern that of the kind that you just talked about, the one who works by accepting it and choosing to do something else.
Well, doubt is natural, right? Okay, so just as anger is natural, doubt is natural, uncertainty is natural. So that's it's a part of our conscious experience is going to be that at times we'll feel uncertain. So the uncertainty arises. But then, how do we respond to that? This is the question. So if we habitually react to uncertainty with worry, say, you know, we always just go into worry, that's what we have to see, right? Or on the other hand, the other extreme would be if uncertainty comes up, we say, oh, she'll be right, and we're very dismissive of that. That's also dangerous, because doubt, you know, you kind of, the incense is burning and kind of feel some heat on the shrine and it's burning more and more. Oh, it doesn't matter, just a bit of doubt, just let go and the shrine burns down. doubt is neither right nor wrong, right? But it's our way of either being dismissive or lost in it. So let's say I notice that my particular habit maybe is one that I always take. Like I went through a period where I was really contemplating the what enlightenment was intellectually and how different traditions talked about that. And I had a lot of doubt about that, intellectual doubt. And I give this story quite often. And I read Ken Wilber's book, which gave a lovely synthesis of all the ways different traditions talk about enlightenment. And I had this kind of intellectual confidence. Oh, now I know. Right? Having read his books, figured it out, followed the arguments, yeah, now I know. And 3 days later, I doubt again. And then doubt came up. Well, did he mean this or did he mean that? Was it that or that? And I could see that kind of intellectual doubt, for me, came and went. Sometimes I felt intellectually confident. Sometimes I felt intellectually doubtful. And I began to see that I wanted intellectual confidence all the time. I wanted to be sure. And when I saw that, I said, well, it's okay not to be sure. And then when my mind, then, from then on, when my mind starts to go into seeking intellectual confidence from just reading someone else, just desire. That's the desire to have confidence. So I worked it out for myself around that kind of a doubt. And so now sometimes my mind says, you don't know anything. And sometimes it says, you know a lot. You know, and it's just the mind saying this or that. But I can see doubt as a condition of mind. And then on a social or practical level, if there's doubt, I know how to use doubt in terms of maybe social organization or the physical organization of the monastery and so on and so forth. So for me, that was an important lesson in doubt. So you see what I mean? That it's natural. What do I do with it? How do I, you know, do I use it skillfully or does it use me? Do I get lost with it? Am I dismissive? So then if you find some really strong habit and there's a lot of doubt, and sometimes you just say no. You know, you just shift away from it. You know, something like, for me, it was more around pessimism, cynicism, a lot of kind of just cynical mind, you know, and the mind just going into cynical judgments about life. And I just, no, I'm back to the breath. But I had to, you know, I had to watch that whole pattern to understand it in myself. Right? So everything's natural. Uncertainty's natural. But what does thought do with it? Is it skillful? Is it unskillful? And I think that for me, the litmus test is around the I thought. There's a difference between smelling something and thinking, is that a fire or is that incense? That's not what I consider I thought. It's just kind of logical thought. But the I thought is like when the sense of self, oh, what am I going to do? Am I right? Am I wrong? The kind of scenario, storyline self, psychological self. That is a sign of attachment. That's the way we actually sometimes define attachment, that kind of thinking. And that's what you have to really be aware of, patterns.
I'm aware
of that. Lots of self-doubt. Okay, so can you find a space between those thoughts? And that's what you start to work with. And so you recognize that self-doubt thought, and then see it end, and just listen to the country and western. And you begin to see like self-doubt thought, just as you can listen to a song. It's just, you know, you don't like the self-doubt thought, like if you don't like country and western, but it's all right, you survive. Kind of comes and goes. Huh? So to, like, you see, when you awaken to thought, you're not thinking. When you notice that you've been thinking, that's the end of thought, but you don't tend to notice the space between thoughts, and you start thinking again. So if I'm meditating, and then maybe I get lost in some kind of scenario about next year or whatever, and then someone coughs, and then, oh, I've been thinking. Oh, I'm thinking too much. I should stop thinking. So you kind of go into thinking again. But to notice the space between thoughts, the end of an I thought, a psychological self thought, and you see that it's very empty of any of this psychological self. It's very pure, very empty. And that's teaching around emptiness, silence, stillness. Whereas the struggle we have with thought tends to be we try to get rid of it or replace it, so we get into these inner arguments. You know, we kind of stop thinking, or you're thinking too much, which is more thinking. I shouldn't be angry. I'm being angry again. I should be loving, which is more anger. So it's kind of like these cycles of kind of self-destructive cycles. But do realize, having seen a pattern, it takes a while. It takes a long time often for these patterns to actually resolve themselves. Because that's karma. That's how you can, you know, karma rather than like you're going to win the lotto kind of karma. You know, karma as habits of mind. As an aside, I have a friend who doesn't want to win the lotto, like the big one, millions, because she's afraid of using up all her good karma in one shot. Interesting thought. Anyway, any other questions?
Sometimes I get up in the morning and all excited and all happy that I'm going to learn more and to know more and be
a better person because I'm in such a good mood. And what's wrong with the craving of being a better person, learning more about Buddhism, about compassion?
That's, well, it's a hard one to actually define. Desire is okay, aspiration is okay, but craving is a particular, in the Pali it's called tanha, craving. And it has to do with ego becoming. And the real liberation of the heart is finding the that which in you which is deathless and timeless and peaceful, right? And that's not something that you get in time. It's by abandoning the whole sense of becoming. So like, let's say, when my mind maybe is always caught up with anger, that anger prevents me to see my real stillness, my real home. But if I learn how to abandon the anger, let go of it, then I begin to discover my real home. Right? Now, that's an aspiration I have, to be free from anger, right? But if it's done from ego, from the self sense, it won't work. It has to be done from wisdom. So there's nothing wrong with waking up and thinking, great, I'm going to work on myself and become a better person. But it is around like what I find with a lot of Western meditators, a very strong self-judgment. I shouldn't be angry. Rather than say, oh, this is anger, how do I go beyond it? A lot of self-criticism, self-disparagement around this aspiration to be a better person. And that comes from kind of ego idealism. So like an ideal is fine, like let's say you have an ideal to be a better person, to understand yourself. But attachment to an ideal creates a conflict. You have this ideal to be a good person, and then the karma that comes up or the habit that comes up is that you're a creep. Right? And the creepy part of you is in conflict with the idealized part of you. And if you don't see the ideal as a goal that you're working towards in the moment, then you're going to hate yourself. Because you haven't reached that ideal. But if you have that ideal, right, and you want to work towards that, you begin to look at creepiness, and you begin to understand creepiness in this moment and how to let go of it so that you can realize your true potential. So it's what I suggest you kind of look at the texts and go to the Four Noble Truths, which is the basic teaching, and look at the second and third noble truths. Second truth is attachment to craving is the cause of suffering. Third noble truth is the abandonment of craving is the end of suffering. And it's that craving is very, I mean, your question is very good. It's very important. Because we see a difference between aspiration for the good and ego craving. And that's what you have to understand in the spiritual life. So maybe if you do a bit of study, look into that, into what that language is about, craving, tanha, see what that means. We all want to be, I mean, we wouldn't be doing this if we weren't, you know, yearning for a better, you know, to be better people, for sure. But how do you do that without feeling guilty? How do you do that without self-criticism, self-judgment? You know, how do you do that in a way which is compassionate rather than this kind of inner violence that we often put upon ourselves from idealism, attachment to ideals? Yeah, it comes from experience, right? It comes from seeing very, very clearly what the mind is doing. It comes from probably having resolved a lot of emotional stuff around that. So, in I think the kind of... One of the ways to look at it is the idea of purification. That, let's go back to something like resentment. I'm betrayed by someone and I have very strong resentments. Well, the first year of those resentments, say, you might have a lot of emotional impact. And you, wow, you know, kind of really powerful. And then you just have to bear with it. But then maybe after 5 years, all that emotional stuff you've burned off, you just find the habit of resentful thought. Right? So having worked off that emotion, you just see the mind just does that. You know, as a kind of, you know, each time the memory of that person comes up, it just goes into this kind of, it was unfair, poor me, kind of mind state. Saying, you say, no, I'm not going to get reborn into that. So that's why I think, like, body awareness around these various emotional things that we go through helps to resolve that initial strong karma. But the mind has become habituated to that kind of thinking, and then the kind of no comes from clarity. It doesn't come from repression. So it's a kind of, you know, stages. And if it doesn't work, it'll just keep coming back, you know. So it'll keep knocking on your door.
I'm not sure sometimes if I know the difference between being aware, having an aware moment, or having a thought moment, because there's like a picture. Like when I'm aware of my breath, there's this actual sort of almost medical picture of this breath.
Do you think in thoughts or in concepts? Do you think in pictures or in concepts?
In pictures.
Okay, yeah. So it seems to be a... Some people are quite pictorial, some people are more conceptual. When you listen to this lovely music, is there any picture?
When I first heard the music, it brought me immediately back to moments in the past when that type of music was around.
So it brought up memory?
It brought a memory, and it brought a picture with it.
And then that picture, did you pursue that picture with other pictures?
I didn't pursue it, but I was aware of the fact that it brought this picture.
Right.
And then I let go of it, and then I wasn't aware of the music any longer. It was not so much... not aware of it, but I didn't allow it to grab me, and I didn't continue with the picture.
if you hadn't been aware, would the way your mind is set up, would you have pursued one picture with another picture? Well, for me, I'm conceptual, I'm not pictorial. So when I get lost in thought, right, so let's say a sound triggers a memory, and then the memory goes into a conceptual storyline with a bit of picture, but not. I'm not very video type, right? It's more kind of sound and thought, and then I would notice that, and that would be the end of it, and that noticing would be the arising of mindfulness. I wouldn't be caught in it. Now, do the same kind of scenarios happen to you in terms of pictures? Okay.
I'm not sure. I've been struggling with this for years. Like, what is a thought moment and what's an aware moment? I mean, I am very aware of my foot touching the ground. I feel that. But there is also a picture forming in my mind at the same time.
Well, that's fine.
But is that a thought moment or an aware moment?
Why don't you not define it?
Okay.
You know, if you get into having to define it, you're in doubt. Mm-hmm. So it's actually not the problem. Isn't the thought more than aware? It's the doubt. And then from the doubt, the mind gets confused. So say, I don't know what it is, but it's this way. So give up the definitions and just see it as it is. And then whatever you have to learn on you know, kind of comes to you intuitively rather than through definitions. So look at the doubt around that. Whenever you have, oftentimes you think you have a problem, but it's just the doubt. So often I find with questions, am I being too angry or too soft? Well, you're doubting. So look, and doubt is a much more subtle kind of hindrance to mind than, say, anger. Doubt is much more kind of insidious. I'm not saying it is doubt, but, you know, look at that very doubt. And just don't put any definitions on it. Just allow it to be in its purity. If you have a sense that you know you're here now, you're present, then that's what we mean by awareness. And its manifestations can come as thought, can be aware of thought. But it's the getting lost in it. And especially the I thought, what I call the psychological self, that's really where the attachment, the grosser kinds of attachments are. And each of us, I mean, yodeling, each of us...
See, I wasn't even aware of that.
I'm very sound oriented. Each of us has a kind, you know, different kind of conditioning. Our minds are conditioned different ways. We have different energies, different ways we perceive and conceive things. So if you take something simple, like this kind of idea of receptivity, which I use, just being receptive and open and attentive, awake, get a feeling for that. And then the way it manifests in mind and is defined and so on, how perception works, because that's what's happening. We all have perceptions. So you have a kind of pictorial perception. That's all right. Yeah. If you allow it to do it, because that's the way I work with fear too. Very physical, very physical. But as soon as it gets in the storyline, and go back to the body. You literally just feel the energy go up into your head, and then back down here again. Fear is the problem. You know, it's the kind of. That's why I think I like to talk about faith, because. Do that. You got to have faith, don't you? This is going to work. Not kind of faith in Buddha, but just this kind of optimism that this will work. And it does work. Awareness is really quite magical. Any others?
I have a friend who's very, at times very paralyzed by fear and in a kind of agricultural kind of way. She does go into the fear of being afraid of fear itself, and can't function. And sometimes makes associations with things like even being on a bus. Just has to can't get on a bus or can't get her go and do something that's where she might have had a panic attack somewhere. Do you have any kind of advice for that kind of very deep fear?
Well, when anything's overwhelming, you can't work with it because you can't get the sati awareness around it, right? So then I always contemplate, well, how could you build up the person's strengths? I mean, I don't know the person, you have to figure it out yourself. So then I look at the person and say, okay, that's not going to work. Directly going to the heart's not going to work because they just get paralytic. So then I just try to figure out how could I help this person build up a foundation of awareness so that eventually, when this comes, they have some distance around it. So with fear, typically a lot of metta practice, so that the sense of the world being a threatening thing, try to slowly change it to the world being a benevolent place. So lots of metta practice, trying to introduce those kinds of ideas. More and more body awareness, just in ordinariness, not around fear, just suggesting the person get out of the head into the body, get out of the head into the body. Reading literature which is inspiring rather than frightening. So like reading literature about Jerusalem right now, it's pretty depressing. So just saying get away from that, kind of bring in inspiring, positive kind of mind state. So what you try to do with a person who can't get mindfulness around certain difficult things is build a foundation. How can you build a foundation? And you only know that yourself from your own practice. But what is the foundation? It's like all the emotional qualities that we develop are always like gratitude, generosity, metta, all those, morality. When a person's moral, they know, they're living a good life, those things. Try to get all that in place. Good works, things like that. So the whole idea of the world being a threatening place somehow gets undermined in a good way through ideas of benevolence. And keep working on that. And when the person gets overwhelmed by it, just help them through it the best you can. Begin again, keep developing those attitudes. But your own practice and your own love of someone and your own intuition would often give you wonderful responses, because you have a feeling for the person, plus you understand your own work. And the way to do that is quite often is very good listening rather than fixing. You know, I'm offering you kind of fix-it stuff, but first of all, you got to listen and really, really intuitively feel the person. How does Buddhism work? How does it work outside of just techniques? What are the fundamentals and foundations of a good practice? That can, yeah. Introduce that idea that this will change. That's very good. Very, very good. Very powerful. Just that, because depression has a sense of permanency, doesn't it? It's very black. This will always be black, and it'll get worse. And if the psyche can bring up, but this will change, that's a powerful antidote to the sense of permanency around this thing. This will change. So in encouraging someone, just like you're saying, just do that. Hang in, bear with it, it'll change. So you're the person's wisdom. Even though they say, no, it won't change, it'll change. So keep reassuring them that. That's a very powerful one. With the goodies too, huh? What else? Anything else?
You talked about faith in the morning and about people who do not have faith in the Buddha. How about faith in the Dhamma, which is the way things are, which is the reality?
Well, I think I was trying to bring forth a more devotional quality, but yeah, faith in Dhamma is, yeah. Yeah, that's part of it. It's all three. Faith in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. I think with Westerners, I'm exploring ways of bringing up devotion. Because we tend to be so analytical and clinical. And the kind of heart opening. I think like for Westerners who come into Buddhism, the ones that come to Theravada, the ones that go to kind of born again Christianity, or into guru type of religion, They're the faith types. Ones that come in Theravada, usually I find are very analytical. They have good analytical minds. And so I'm often exploring ways of trying to bring forth the devotional qualities, which from you, your culture is much more natural. You have that as a kind of given. But faith in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha is the traditional faith. So Sangha too, and Sangha represents not just us characters, you know. It's like morality, faith in morality. Faith in Dana, those kinds of things. But the emotional quality of like gratitude, say sometimes, say in Thailand, or whenever, when we have big festivals in the monastery and you get hundreds of people, full moon, and this kind of great joyous feeling of gratitude, those are really very helpful energies for the practice. But just the, you know, what faith is, even faith in Dharma, but what is faith? What is that? What is that aspect? What do you have faith in? We all have faith. Those are important questions. So if you have faith in Anicca, you know, you're in Dharma. If you have faith in depression, you're in depression. We do. Shall we finish with a bit of enlightened meditation? Let's stretch your legs a bit. Then we'll sit. Listen to sound now. And move away from thought and just listen. Get a sense of being here now. Feel the room, the temperature of the room, the sounds, the feeling of people around you. How does it all feel to be here now? And move away from thought. Away from the past or the future, so you're in the present moment. So they're listening to sound, being present. And feeling the body, feel the posture. So feel the weight of the body on the ground, the pressure. Feel your hands, the warmth, the pressure of the hands on your lap or on your knees. So we're not thinking, but we're actually noticing things in the present moment. And the same way you can feel your hands, feel your breath. Physical sensation of in-breath, so the lungs expanding. Feel that, the body filling with air. And then the out-breath, the lungs contracting. So moving away from thought into bodily feeling. Now try to sustain awareness on the feeling of the breath for a whole in-breath and a whole out-breath. So it's a very physical awareness. So you're not up in your head thinking, you're in your body. And each time your energy goes up into your head and you start thinking and you notice that, then come back to the body in a very kind of caring way. And feel a whole in-breath, feel a whole out-breath. This calms the mind. So let's just do that for a while. This is a training rather than an attempt to get something. So it's not like you're trying to get some kind of experience, but you're training in present moment awareness, body awareness, for a whole in-breath, and then a whole out-breath. And this gives mind the calmness and strength. if your mind wanders a lot into thoughts of past or future, whatever, then make a very clear intention. Just say to yourself, now I'm observing the breath. So make quite clear determination of what you're doing. And then if you're getting dull and sleepy, then open your eyes, stretch your back, put more vitality into your posture, meditate with your eyes open, So if you're leaning against the wall and you're falling asleep, then come off the wall if you can. Then if you are sleepy, use the posture as the object of meditation. Forget about the breath. The breath is too subtle. So just the posture. Straighten your back out, open your eyes, and then just watch sleepiness as it begins to affect your mind and body, and then revitalize the posture until the energy is balanced. try to really feel the body, feel the in-breath. Because sometimes we're in a sort of low-level thought mode. You kind of know you're breathing, but you're not really feeling the physical sensations of breath. So then you can choose something very obvious, like the chest or the belly. And then notice, what does the in-breath feel like? How does the muscles in the chest and they expand the physical feelings, not thought. And then when it contracts, what does that feel like? So that observation collects all the scattered energy of thought into the breath, which then calms the mind. But it's not done with greed, rather it was just simple observation. See, like you're investigating the feeling of the in-breath, feeling of the out-breath. let's do some walking meditation then. Say, half, you ring the bell? Yeah. Half an hour. For those of you who don't know what we do, choose to find a little bit of space to walk back and forth, basically. Mark the ends of your path. Maybe if you've got 10 paces, 15 paces, mark it with a stick or something. Start at one end and use it as a body meditation. Use the feeling of your feet touching the ground. Very, very grounded. Try to get away from the head. Come into the body. Try to be present in the moment. So if your mind starts to project about the future or the past, say, no, I'm here now. And then just walk and make the meditation object the feeling of your feet touching the ground. Very simple. One, two, three. Just walk. Walk to the end of the path. Stop. I'm here now. Turn around. Stop. And walk to the other end. So this stopping at the end is like a way of awakening, because what you find is in the middle you kind of go off to Thailand kind of thing. You know, the mind wanders and does its things, and then you get to the end of that, oh, I'm in Ottawa. And so you keep breaking into the kind of wandering mind, the proliferating mind, come back to the moment, back to the moment. And that, you do that for a day of sitting, walking, it calms the whole mind down. And you also see the patterns of your mind. So it's quite simple. You're not trying to attain anything. You're just sustaining awakeness, sustaining awareness. All right? Back and forth. So let's do that for half an hour.